Welcome to Preaching and Preachers, a weekly podcast devoted to those who preach and to the task of preaching itself. I'm your host, Jason Allen, president of Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. Today, I want to welcome Dr. Don Carson to the podcast. Dr. Carson serves as research professor of New Testament at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, where he's been teaching since 1978. He has a global preaching and teaching ministry and has authored or edited more than 60 books. Dr. Carson is a founding member of the Gospel Coalition and currently serves as its president. Dr. Carson, welcome to Preaching and Preachers.
It's my privilege to be with you again.
Today, I want to visit with you and really frame up the topic with you, reflecting on 40 years of theological education. You now have been teaching at Trinity since 1978 and taught in other posts before Trinity, and so roughly the 40-year mark. And I want to introduce this conversation by probing you a bit as to how Don Carson became Don Carson. And those of us of my generation, I'm in my late 30s, and we have only known you as one who was already on the landscape as a prominent theologian, as a prominent scholar. But as I've gotten to know you more closely over the years and gotten to know you even personally since hosting you on campus in Kansas City, those perceptions of you have kind of come into full color. And you're a man who is a gifted theologian, a gifted scholar, but also a man who is a very warm-hearted evangelical. It's clear your love for evangelism is so obvious. Your pastoral care and attention is so very clear as well. You're mindful of people. You engage people. And in so many ways, you reflect what Christianity and Christian virtues are to be. And I say that not just to flatter to you. I say that as one who's curious and one who I suppose represents the curiosities of many listening to this podcast. How Don Carson became Don Carson. Tell us your story a bit. What formed you into the man of God that you've become?
Well, for a start, you're far too generous. I was reared in a Christian family, so I was brought up knowing the Bible. We had family devotions and family prayers every day. That's a background that is hard to make up if you haven't had it. Mm-hmm. If you become a Christian at 29 and before that never cracked the Bible, well, you can do a lot of reading, but it doesn't get into your bones, into your very system the way it does when you've been brought up. We played Bible games on Sunday afternoon, and we sang. We sang Bible choruses. The Canadian Sunday School Mission, as it was called, CSSM, produced things like, "These are the names of Jacob's sons, Gad and Asher and Simeon, Reuben, Issachar, Levi, Judah, Dan, and Naphtali, 12 and all but never twins, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin. I will spare your audience by not singing it." But the point is, that was
impressive.
That was, you know, another one for the 12 apostles and the maps of the Bible. Now, first the line of coast we make, then Merom next, the marshy lake, and then comes dear old Galilee exactly east of Carmel. See, the Jordan River flows through both into the Dead Sea in the south. Meanwhile, the Great Sea westward lies, and so on. I mean, this was part of my mother's ministry. Milk. It was part of the background. None of that saves you. None of that guarantees how you will turn out. But if the Lord, by His grace, does work in your heart, then it's part of the grist for the mill that shapes how you think.
And so, what age did you become a believer?
That's a hard question to answer. I either became a Christian when I was 8, almost 9, at a camp in Canada, where I heard a preacher called Sam Michalaski expound the gospel. I was brought up in a gospel-believing home, a gospel-believing church, but that spoke to me. But I really don't know if I was a kid coming to faith then or in second-year university when I was reading chemistry and mathematics at McGill. I think that's a not uncommon experience for kids brought up in Christian homes. I was either a kid whom God saved when I was almost 9, and then the Lord led me through teen years and so on, not with wild rebellion, but trying to find my own feet until university. Or alternatively, He spared me from the worst pitfalls of youth until He got me to close with Him at second-year university. I don't know which it is. I have a mental checklist of things to ask God when I get to glory someday, and one of them is, "When did you save me?" And He will probably smile and say, "From before the foundation of the world, my son." So beyond that, I can't answer that question. And then I headed off to university and did chemistry. My intention was to go and do graduate work in organic synthesis. I was not heading for the ministry. And then through a variety of, of experiences. The Lord gradually changed me into another direction. But you must not think for a moment that there was some early period in my life where I sort of plotted things out and said, these are the steps that I will take so that at the age of 60 or 70 I will be doing this or that. I had no intention of doing a PhD. I had no intention of becoming a minister. I had no intention of writing a lot of books. I had no intention of moving south of the 49th parallel. There were so many things I had no intention of. I mean, the Lord dumped me from one to the other with surprising frequency. And the person most surprised as often as not was me. It seemed sort of inevitable at the time. But if people ask the kinds of questions you're asking, meaning to say, how did you order your life to get to this place so I can order my life to get to the same sort of place? Then I just want to laugh.
Right.
Because that's just not what happened. It would be giving far too much credit to one person when my life is a life of surprising narratives, it has to be said.
Now, did you undertake the PhD at Cambridge intending to teach on the backside of that, or were you still thinking perhaps pastoral ministry?
By the time I started that, I had planted two churches, one in English, one in French. I did another one later, and had become pastor of another church in Vancouver. I was still single. And the church was beginning to grow and flourish. We bought ground for expansion and so on. We were ready to go. And then at a local Baptist theological college, they lost someone to death, and they asked me if I would consider joining their faculty. Well, I had an MDiv and a couple of degrees toward a THM, a couple of courses toward a THM. That was it. And so it was silly even to consider me, but I was what was available and local and so on. But that was the first point when I began to think maybe I should get some more training while I'm still young and single.
Hmm.
And so it was not, I am going to get some more training so that I can teach at college, or because I want to give up pastoral ministry, or because I've had enough of this, thank you, or anything like that. It was maybe I should get some more training so I have some more flexibility and won't make a complete idiot of myself if I do have to teach a course now and then. And so I actually applied to Manchester University because I had taken some summer courses from F.F. Bruce, and I'd got to know him, and he accepted me and so on. And then a fellow pastor in Vancouver said, you ought to consider Cambridge. And I said, probably never get in there. Well, as it turns out, he bullied me until I applied and was accepted into Cambridge. The first weekend I was in Britain, on the streets of Cambridge, I bumped into F.F. Bruce. And he said, what are you doing here? And I was sort of embarrassed. And I said, well, when push came to shove, finally I had an opportunity to come here, and I thought I'd come to Cambridge instead. And he said, well, I can't criticize you for that. I came to Cambridge too. He was very gracious about the whole thing.
Yeah, let me interrupt you. I'm just curious, as a slight digression, what was F.F. Bruce like personally?
F.F. Bruce's greatest strength was his writing. His lecturing was very much like his writing being read. He was not in any sense a dynamic preacher, but he was invariably careful and was absolutely brilliant in Q&As.
Hmm.
Absolutely brilliant. He had a massive knowledge of biblical texts and related literatures. He was not warm and cuddly. He was Scottish in his rootage, was a bit distant, but not in the sense that he was sort of off-putting or rude. He was private, very hard worker, and very precise in his use of language. But at the time, he exercised formidable influence in biblical exegesis in the English-speaking world, partly because there were so few people like him.
Right.
We forget that 60, 70, 80 years ago, we forget how very, very, very few front-rank biblical commentary writers were out there who were genuinely evangelical. Very, very few.
Right.
And he was the best of them by far.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, there are lots and lots of F.F. Bruces, if I may put it that way. So the fruit of his life has been a lot more like him.
So you're at Cambridge, you complete your PhD, come back this side of the Atlantic. How do you wind up at Trinity in 1978?
When I finished my PhD, I was torn between serving as theological secretary in Europe for IFES and taking up this teaching post back at this college back in Vancouver. That was a long story, and how the Lord led there is a long and painful narrative that I'll skip. But I landed back in Vancouver, and my wife and I planted another church on the side. But at the end of 3 years, I didn't really like the way things were going in the college and its direction for a number of reasons. So I thought, okay, I'll go back to my first love, which is pastoral ministry in any case. So I announced at Christmas that I was leaving the following summer. And that Christmas, I read a paper at the Evangelical Theological Society. In those days, ETS and SBL actually met between Christmas and New Year. Sounds bizarre now, but that's when they met. And it was down in San Francisco that year, and I read something on John's Gospel. And in the audience, unbeknown to me, was Kenneth Concer, who was the dean at Trinity.
Sure.
And he heard me and asked if I would talk to him about these matters. And I said, well, if you'd caught me 2 months ago or 2 months from now, the answer would be no, but I am in transition. I'll at least talk to you. He said, breakfast tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock. And things just leapfrogged from there, so that Trinity issued an invitation, and by the next autumn, I was down on the Trinity campus.
Did he know you before that paper, or was he just heard you and
just heard
your
me
gifting?
And he didn't know. I knew of him, but I hadn't met him, and I doubt that he knew me before.
So 1978, here we are in the year 2016. So much has changed since then, and I'm curious as far as from your vantage point, I want to unpack several different questions with you. But first and foremost, how has theological education changed from 1978 to 2016?
One could easily mention a lot of different things. There are far more schools around now that are evangelical. There are more modes of delivery. The whole digital world wasn't around 40 years ago. There have been several movements that have passed through. The stellar scholars in those days that were senior saints and exercising influence that was maybe waning a bit because of their advanced years were people like Carl F. H. Henry and Kenneth Concer himself and others of that generation. And eventually at Trinity, we did a video series in the early, mid-'80s where we titled it Know Your Roots, where we asked Concer and Henry.
I viewed those.
Did you?
Yes, sir. They're very well done.
They're interesting.
They were very interesting.
And not only did they give their lectures, but then on the last day, I interviewed them and asked them all kinds of things, what they thought about Billy Graham and with the Southern Baptist Convention, which was beginning to go through the throes of self-destruction.
And by the way, Concer's handicapping was very astute at that juncture point.
Oh, yes,
SBC.
It was. Yeah. Oh, that's right. That's exactly right. But the best moment on that whole video series, I think, was toward the end when I asked them, some Christian leaders become grumpy old men. They become defensive, and they resent the younger men coming along behind, and they begin to destroy what they built up and just become bitter. But both of you keep looking forward. You're an encourager to others coming along behind. How have you managed it? Now, don't tell me it's the grace of God. I know it's the grace of God. How has the grace of God so worked out in your life that you haven't become grumpy old men? And they both sort of spluttered a bit and didn't know quite what to say or how to respond and so on. And then Carl quietly said, how can anybody be arrogant when he stands beside the cross? Greatest moment on the whole thing. You can still download those things and get them from a variety of sources. It's called Know Your Roots. So that was the generation that I was brought up with. And eventually John Woodbridge and I edited a Festschrift in Carl's honor in 1981. So that's going back already, just about 30 years. There were waves of students that came through. The charismatic movement came through. Later on, the Toronto Blessing movement came through.
And that showed up at Trinity.
Yes, it's not that everybody that came in was captured by it. Nothing like that. But it was enough in the air that everybody wanted to talk about it.
Understood. Okay.
And some had been captured by it, but everybody wanted to talk about it. And then later it was the emerging church movement. Everybody wanted to talk about Neo and read certain books and so on. Again, not that everybody was captured by it, but that everybody wanted to talk about it. And various reform movements went through and so on. It's been an interesting pilgrimage just to watch the different generations of students. But I have been saying for the last dozen years that the best generation I've ever had going through is right now. By and large, they're serious. Average incoming age at the seminary is probably 28. They're not just out of high school. And they are beyond the race wars of the 60s and 70s. They want to know how to plant multiracial, multi-ethnic inner-city churches. They want to be mentored. They're serious about the gospel. They're doctrinally sober. They don't want soft answers. They want to know how to evangelize Muslims. They have more of a Calebite spirit, give me this mountain, rather than looking for the soft place. Now, there are exceptions, of course, but there is a much higher percentage of this lot coming through now than I've ever seen.
And we sense that here at Kansas City and I know other major evangelical seminaries, including Southern Baptist seminaries. The presidents all say the same thing. There's a seriousness. There's a sense of gravity, a passion, a desire for theological richness. And many of them show up on our campus not with the good wishes of parents and friends, but in spite of the opposition of parents and friends. And so they just show up convictional and ready to give their life to something.
And they're very suspicious of hooey. They're very suspicious of what sham or flaky or phony. Their phoniness antenna are very well attuned. And I think that that bodes well.
I'm curious, we begin the conversation with a little bit of a prologue as to your story and how you became a teacher, a professor, and who you are in Christ. We've talked about how theological education has changed some. We've talked about how students have changed some. How have you changed? 40 years into teaching, any particular points of significance that you fundamentally changed your mind on, that you look back at the age of 25 or 30 or 35, and now you would just fundamentally interpret a passage different or hold to a different position? How has Don Carson changed since 1978?
Well, undoubtedly, I've got older. That probably brings with it that I've mellowed on some things, probably become firmer on other things. At the level of individual passages, it's easy to provide a list. When I wrote my Matthew commentary, which came out in 84, first edition, I had already changed my mind between that and my popular exposition of the Sermon on the Mount, which came out about 80 or 81. And what particular passage? I took one position in that popular level book and then took another position when I got there in 84. So that sort of thing happens not all that uncommonly.
Sure.
You try to be careful and you don't want it to happen too often. But if you make a mistake and you see that you've caught yourself, you understand it a better way, then by all means, if you're covering similar material later, you should correct it. So anybody who knows my work well will know that I've modified bits and pieces here and there. But in terms of overall approach, there has been more modification by sophistication, by becoming more careful, more nuanced than by fundamental. It's not as if I was Greek Orthodox and then became Jehovah's Witness and then lo and behold I became an evangelical. It's not, I haven't gone through revolutions like that, nor that I started off massively Arminian, then became massively Reformed. It hasn't been anything like that. There have been several slow evolutions that have taught me that there are certain immutables in Scripture that you cannot deny, and they've got to be worked into your thinking. I owe certain steps of growth to one or two men at different stages. A Baptist minister by the name of Ken Hall, who took me aside one summer and taught me a little better how to pray. That was a significant summer. So there have been some people like that along the line who have made the distinctive marks. I can think of all the mistakes and stupid things I've said and false judgments I've had, but the Lord has been very merciful.
Well, one of the things that hasn't changed throughout 40 years of public ministry is your productivity. You've been remarkably productive year to year. And one of the things I was visiting with a colleague here yesterday about your ministry, and I said, you've been able to produce, you know, major books every year, sometimes more than one a year. At the same time, a constant outflow of articles, both scholarly and popular, and I love the balance of your ministry of writing, you know, making significant contributions through major books, but also writing an article here, an article there, and preaching here and there. And not just the heavy academic settings like SBL or ETS, but local churches, pastors' conferences. I know many are wondering, how does Don Carson, how have you maintained this pace of productivity? So I know there's no secret to it. Some of it's just old-fashioned hard work, sitting down and doing it. But what have you learned about personal productivity over the years? And don't say, by the grace of God. I will give you that word as you gave your colleagues.
But But it is the grace of God in a variety of ways. Some people need more sleep than others. So that if you're a person who needs 8 hours sleep, or else you become grumpy, you are morally obligated, I would say, to get 8 hours sleep because you don't have the right to be grumpy. So how much sleep that you need is a factor. Whether you have any sort of gift for concentration, that's a factor. Moreover, I don't. You're giving me far too much credit. I don't kill myself. I mean, I work hard, and when I'm working, I can concentrate pretty well. But on the other hand, I'm happy to take a half day off and go for a long walk, or to watch a program on TV with my wife, or I'm doing things on the side with the Gospel Coalition that are administrative and so on. And it's partly a question of using time well, filling every minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, as Rudyard Kipling puts it in his poem, If. Partly it's looping different things into different corners of your life. For example, if I'm on the road, I can bring my laptop and write something at a popular level, but I can't write anything at an academic level. I don't have my resources all around me. I therefore plan my writing depending on whether I'm on the road or I'm at my desk or and with all my resources around me. So a little bit of planning and forward work, that helps. Another thing is I tend to know what the next 10 projects are. And that's not being dramatic or making a great claim or anything. What it means is that almost everything I read, and I read very broadly, is something that is grist for the mill for one or the other of those projects. If you finish one project completely and it's entirely out of your hand before you even start thinking of the next project, then you're starting all over again to gather material. But if you know what your next 10 projects are, then everything that you read is fitting in somewhere.
Right, that's good.
You see? And so that becomes a way of saving time and becoming a little more productive. Early on, developing a card index system that is morphed into a digital system for retrieving materials. I spend time with my students showing how you can index systems and retrieve materials because nobody remembers everything unless they have an eidetic memory, which I don't have. So in that case, an awful lot depends on how you retrieve things. So those are little hints along the way. But I don't have a ghost writer. Every word I write myself. What can I say? One word at a time.
That's good. I'm curious. We're thinking about, again, theological education, your role in it, how you've changed, how your life has morphed from season to season. We talked about consistencies there. We talked about your personal productivity, how God has used you many different ways to serve the church. What, as you look at the church and especially the evangelical movement and especially the students coming into our seminaries, graduating from our evangelical seminaries, we've already sort of intimated the fact that we're encouraged by it, but project that a bit further out. What is your hopefulness for the generation to come in light of what you're seeing now in the seminaries?
It depends a bit on what part of the world. I mean, part of my world responsibilities, because Trinity is so international, because the Gospel Coalition, the digital world does not recognize national borders. I'm on every continent except Antarctica every year or two. And so when you ask that question sort of worldwide, it really, the answer I would give would change very much. What my hope is, it would change very much from country to country to country. Here in America, I think that there is a fundamental tension that's building up, and I don't know which way it's going to break. On the one hand, there is massive decline on all sorts of God-ordained indexes of morality and truth and integrity and right thinking and joyful holiness and so on. We've lost so much and we're going to lose a lot more. But at the same time, God has raised up stronger evangelical seminaries. Some denominations and associations are becoming rejuvenated. The influences of things like T4G and Nine Marks and TGC and DGM and so on, they're also making their own massive appeals to a new generation that are serious about the Word and expository preaching and teaching. And what is not clear to me is whether this rise from the hand of God of a new generation of serious churchmen is going to be enough to turn the tide against the drowning effect of massive idolatry that is washing over the country. And I would say that if not, the advantage is still to the church. Christ is still saying, I will build my church and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. But it's going to become in the context of a little more difficulty, a little more challenge, a little more persecution. I can imagine superficial things like losing tax advantages and harsher things like spending time in jail. All of that is quite possible in the next half generation here in North America. On the other hand, it's also possible that God in his mercy will turn the tide as he did with Whitfield and Wesley and Howell Harris and so on at the time of the Great Awakening. And it's just too early to say which way it's going to break. But it is heading for a massive confrontation, a clash. And which way it will break, I just wouldn't want to guess.
That's good. This has been helpful. This has been encouraging. It's been interesting. And I want to just land the plane with the final question. We're talking about ministry, talking about teaching theological education over the course of now 4 decades for you. The local church needs pastors with long tenures. 2 or 3 years and out, 2 or 3 years and out is really a scourge on the church. What would be your encouragement to those of us listening to this podcast about cultivating tenure in a ministry post, whether it's teaching at a seminary, but most especially pastoring a church? How do you wake up 30, 40 years later, and you've been there just being faithful, plodding away decade after decade? Give us a concluding word of encouragement.
The primary reason why people move on after 3 years or 3.5 years or whatever the national average is now is because they've run out of things to say. They've shot their wad. That's it. And the reason why they have is because they're not continuing to study. Somebody who gives himself to the ministry of the Word is always finding more fresh things in the Word. And if that's combined with genuine pastoral care for individuals and maybe catechizing in some cases and watching whole families grow up, eventually you're picking up the old Puritan dream of ministers and the cure of souls, which presupposes theological depth and good diagnosis and real care and prayerful times. Usually a rapid changeover in ministry reflects pretty substantial shallowness on the part of the minister. Now, it's not always the case. Sometimes a church has got some nasty people in it that keep jerking people out every once in a while. Of course, the blames can be shunted around. But by and large, the thing that leads most toward long-term, profitable, stable, cross-generational ministry is growth, personal growth on the part of the ministry. In terms of the Word, how to teach it, not only from the pulpit, but in small groups and one-on-one and multiplying discipleship and training others to do it and so on. A holistic ministry that is genuinely Word-driven. And that demands study, prayer, humility, care, and real love for people for Jesus' sake.
And when your ministry is Word-driven and you spend half your week, give or take, thinking about the passage before you to preach,
yeah,
it dominates your mind, and your spare time goes to not fantasizing about greener grass, but your spare time goes to what exactly did Paul mean in verse 8?
Especially if you're planning ahead like that. If you're doing expository ministry where you know weeks and weeks and weeks in advance what the passage is going to be, you start building to the future.
That's right. Dr. Carson, this has been an encouraging conversation. Thank you for joining me for Preaching and Preachers and for visiting with us about 40 years in theological education. Thank you.
My privilege to be with you.
Thank you for listening to Preaching and Preachers. For more information, please visit my website, jasonkallen.com.